arguing for 25 minutes is Ronald Raggetts, 25 minutes John Green, 5 minutes Doug Anderson, and 5 minutes Ronald Raggetts in rebuttal. So we'll start with Mr. Raggetts.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ron Raggetts. I'm with the Madison, Wisconsin law firm of DeWitt Ross & Stevens. We represent the appellant in this case, Dairyland Greyhound Park, Inc. Your Honors, for about 150 years of the state's history, there has been no casino gambling in the state. It was clearly illegal. We now, today, have what is a billion-dollar enterprise in Indian casino gambling, and yet the voters of this state have never voted to legalize casino gambling for anyone. We now, as of last spring, have amendments to compacts signed by the governor that would grow casino gambling in this case, in this state, geometrically, and we still not have a vote by the electorate of this state to legalize gambling. And if those amendments are allowed to stand, we will never have a vote by the people or by their elected representatives to legalize gambling, casino gambling, in this state. We believe that is fundamentally wrong, and that's why we're here today.
So your position is that neither the governor nor the legislature nor the two in conjunction can enter these compacts. Is that your position?
Cannot enter compacts that authorize casino gambling.
Which is the 2003 contract, the 1998 amendments, and the 1992.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All three of those are void because they're contrary to the law.
No, not 1991 and 1992 compacts.
Okay.
We had a situation in 1991 and 1992 where a federal judge ordered the state to negotiate for compacts that included casino gambling.
And that's pre-93 constitutional amendment.
That's pre-1993 constitutional amendment.
So the 92 contracts are okay.
The 19, which are of course expired by their terms, or at least the term of those compacts has passed.
I know, but it was amended or renewed in 98.
It was amended, Your Honor.
Right.
And I should correct for the benefit of the court. I believe there was a problem in the premise for the decision in 1991. Nonetheless, we have a federal court that ordered it. We had an appeal that was dismissed because of procedural problems, and the state thereupon did enter into those compacts.
Okay.
Counselor, is it your position that the pre-constitutional amendment compacts, which had a definite term and also could be terminated at the end of that term by either party, have been terminated, or is that still an open question?
Our position, Your Honor, was, and let me just back up to when we filed this lawsuit, which was in October of 2001.
Yeah.
The lawsuit at that point, we had not had renewals. The governor had not allowed the compacts to renew or entered into any amendments. This case was brought as seeking an injunction to prevent the governor from amending the compacts, to extend them in any way, and to require the governor to issue notices of non-renewal. And then, as of that point in time, then the compacts would, one by one, have been non-renewed, would have expired by their own terms, and then we need to look at the provisions of the compacts as to how dispute resolution between the state and the tribes would have progressed.
Does the intent of the compacting parties have anything to do with whether the initial compacts were terminated or extended?
As to whether in 1998
Now, I'm trying to really figure out just what your position is here, and I understand what it is, you know, after the 93 constitutional amendment. What I'm not clear on is the parties that compacted seem to believe that they could go on and compact. Whether that's right or wrong is what we're in court about. But if they relied on that belief, does that have anything to do with whether there is any validity in the initial compacts or none at all?
I don't think that that belief has, as to what would happen at renewal, has anything to do with the validity of the original compacts.
Okay.
I think that the parties entered into compacts, the tribes in the state entered into compacts that were for a fixed duration of 7 years. At the conclusion, or 180 days prior to the conclusion, either party had the unilateral right to non-renew and thereby terminate the compacts without any need for cause, without even giving any kind of reason. It was simply up to either side in their sole discretion.
But neither side terminated them. They extended them is one argument that we're hearing.
They amended them. They entered into amendments. I think that's a point that has relevance. These compacts have never been allowed to, quote, automatically renew.
Right. Well, they have. That's right.
In each instance, they have been amended, and in 98 and 99, they were substantively amended. There were substantive terms of the compacts that were changed. And, of course, as we know from the 2003 amendments signed by Governor Doyle last spring, there are dramatic amendments to those, substantive.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Could I ask you, on the 92 compacts, if neither side had done anything in 1998 or 9, and things just continued to roll over, would you be here?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Because there comes a point every, initially 7 years, after that 5 years, where the state has to make a decision whether to renew or non-renew the compacts. Okay? Both sides have to make a decision. The compacts will not go forward unless both sides consent, essentially, by in the form of declining to give the notice of non-renewal. So, viewing it in terms of last February, Governor Doyle had a decision, the state had a decision, whether to exercise the right to non-renew. The question is, how is that decision made? Who makes it, and how is it made? And specifically, our concern is how it is made, because that's a decision, that's a policy decision that is made, whether it's made by default or it's made affirmatively. It is a policy decision that is made on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. And when we are making that policy decision, which is fundamentally a legislative policy decision because it's a decision about the scope of gambling within the state, the governor, the state, has to follow the Constitution. That is the contract, the agreement by which we are all bound, and the Constitution was amended in 1993 to change, I would say, to clarify and correct the Wisconsin Constitution, the policy embodied in the Constitution as to casino gambling or any form of gambling other than those specifically allowed in the Constitution.
Mr. Raggetts, that constitutional amendment doesn't in any way mention Indian gambling. Why do you think it has such an effect then in regard to these compacts?
Two answers. Well, I guess probably several answers. First of all, hearkening back to what happened in the Lac de Flambeau case, there was never any author, any claim by anyone that the electorate in 1987 or that the people in 87 had specifically authorized Indian casino gambling. Instead, the premise was that the people authorized, perhaps unwittingly, the state itself to conduct casino gambling. And that, through the structure of IGRA, then means that casino gambling would be is permitted for others within the state and thereby can be the subject of a compact. So there never was any authorization specifically in the Constitution or in state statutes or anywhere of Indian casino gambling. All there ever was an authorization for the state to conduct it, and that was removed by the 1993 amendment. I don't believe that the structure of IGRA contemplates that states will directly legislate what is legal or not legal on in terms of gaming on tribal lands. They legislate that through what their policy is, what the state's policy is on the legality of casino gambling and other forms of gambling for others within the state.
Well, once you look at IGRA, you look at the compacts being in effect in 1992, and then you look at the constitutional amendment in 93, how does the constitutional amendment override compacts already in existence and the provisions of IGRA? It seems to me that's what you're arguing, that somehow or other 1993 changed the ballgame.
I do believe that 1993 changed the ballgame. We'll go back to a little bit of that, the terminology there, because I think that's important. But let me answer your question directly. In 1993, there was, let's assume that this is a change in state law. It does not affect the compacts in existence immediately, because there are provisions that changes in state law are superseded by the compact. What it does affect is the governor's ability and duty at the time the compacts come up for renewal, when either side has the wide open discretion to non-renew. The state has to make a decision whether it will non-renew or not. And what does it look to? First place to look to is the Constitution as amended by the 1993 amendment.
So your position is that the governor should never have entered into the 1998 amendments?
Correct. That the governor did not have the authority to enter into those amendments.
The governor didn't have authority because of the constitutional amendment in 93.
That's correct.
Because we have several governor's authority issues that are being posed. So
I understand
we have to
that.
Clarify that.
Yes.
Why didn't you challenge that then?
Well, that's an issue that's been brought up in the form of latches. If you look at this as a timing issue, if one is going to challenge at the time of non-renewal, you know, when the constitutional amendment is passed in 1993, as we just discussed, that would not be the time to challenge. The first time it's up for non-renewal or renewal is 1998. As we've seen in this case, in order to effectively mount a legal challenge, you have to start that process at least 2.5 years before the time comes in order to get it through the trial court and have any chance for effective appellate review. That's how long it took us to get here, and we have expedited this case every step of the way. I don't believe that people likely knew what the governor was going to do about renewal or non-renewal in 98 back in 1996 or 1995. I'm not sure the governor himself would have known.
You didn't bring this lawsuit until October 2001, so
that's correct.
You knew in 98 what the governor had done.
That's correct. That's correct. And so then the next opportunity, if you're going to structure litigation the way we have structured it, which is at the next renewal, we're going to address this issue, the next opportunity was February of last year. And we started this case in October of 2001, perhaps optimistically not recognizing we'd spend the first year on an indispensable party issue, and then run into a situation where we effectively were getting the trial court's decision right on the cusp of the deadlines.
Counsel, it's your position, as I understand it then, that the 1998 amendments violated the Constitution. Is that correct?
Yes.
And if those amendments, the compacts in 1998, violated the Constitution, I assume that the compacts are void from the beginning. That is, you can't enter into an unconstitutional contract. So if they are void from the beginning, under your argument, what's the ramification of voiding those compacts from the beginning?
From the beginning, meaning from 1998?
Yes.
I think the ramification of that would mean that we would effectively be in a position where there would no longer be any compacts for any of the tribal gaming.
Okay. Did the tribes pay any money under those allegedly unconstitutional compacts?
Yes, I believe they did.
Is a possible consequence then to regain money that has been paid illegally or illegally received?
Or not entitled to receive or whatever, yes. I would assume so. That has not been a focus of what we've briefed and presented because of the way our lawsuit is structured, but I would, yes, assume so.
I was thinking about consequences. Any other consequences of your position with regard to the 1998 compacts being unconstitutional at the outset?
Well, let me speak to something that I don't know if this directly addresses your question, but let me try. Of what I would anticipate happening were the court to rule in our favor, or perhaps, well, I'll leave aside the legislator's case and let them speak for themselves. If the court were to so rule, as you have suggested, what do we anticipate that would happen? I would anticipate that there would be, as a practical matter now, an effort at a constitutional amendment that could probably be done in a relatively short period of time, since we happen to be in election year now, and the first legislative vote could take place before the election, second after, and by the spring of 2005, we would be in a position of the electorate voting on this issue. And frankly, I think that is fundamentally a very positive thing, and what should happen. And if we see today what is happening in a small way in the city of Madison, where there is actually a debate, is this good for the community? Is it worth it? Is there's money on this side? There's costs on this side? You know, that's the way democracy functions. That's the way our system should work. This is a huge question. It will affect not only ourselves, but our children and our children's children, because if the amendments are allowed to stand as they are, no one will ever have an opportunity to address them again, not the voters directly, not their legislators, not future governors. It's done. And so I think that is a consequence that we are looking for in this case, and that is how I see the case, how I see developments, consequences playing out if the court were to rule in our favor.
You see any other consequences?
Plus, I see that the 1992 compact is okay because it preceded the constitutional amendment. It had a clause that said if you didn't back out of it, if it's extended, no one backed out of it. So in 1999, it would have been extended. That would have also been extended if no one backed out of it. So we're into a situation where no one's backed out. If we have a continuing contract, which raises the federal constitutional question of impairment of contract, do you see that as a consequence?
Well, I see an issue that is perhaps a step further ahead from where we have been in this case, in terms of what happens when you have compacts that were never allowed to passively renew, that were always affirmatively amended, and we have now determined that the governor was without authority to have affirmatively amended them. Does that mean that the compacts have renewed simply by virtue of the fact that no one has non-renewed them?
Do you see further litigation on this?
I would anticipate that there would be further litigation.
Both in this court and in the federal courts.
I am looking a little into the crystal ball at this point,
sure.
But I would anticipate that there were definitely... I believe the tribes have publicly stated that if there were an adverse ruling from this court, that they would look to remedies in the federal court.
Right. And several of the briefs do state those remedies.
Yes. Okay. And I, if I could just address that one step further, I think that it is nonetheless very important that this court, as the ultimate arbiter, the ultimate determiner of Wisconsin law, speak to this issue, that in many respects, I think that Judge Crabb in the Lac des Flambeaux decision was left with a situation where she didn't have a decision from Wisconsin appellate courts to rely on. She ultimately, I believe, relied on then-Attorney General Doyle's opinion.
In part was her exact language.
Yes. I guess I can't. I don't recall what her exact language is. I firmly believe that that was the basis of her decision. I do see the warning light has gone on.
Could 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
I want to make sure I understand exactly what you're asking the court. Let's suppose the court has read your brief, and on April 1st, no, that's not a big good day. let's say April 7th, we issue an opinion supporting your position. What happens the next day in terms of the Indian casinos?
Well, in terms of what would happen in our lawsuit, in our process, this case would be remanded to the trial court. I mean, unfortunately, we are in a position where when we were at the trial court and had the ability to amend our pleadings, there were no amendments, no signed amendments as of 2003. We have ever since been on appeal, so the case has come up in a posture where if the court were to determine that the governor did not have the authority, as we contend, the case, I believe, will need to go back to the trial court and we will need to make...
Well, what purpose, counsel? What is it going back for? For what legal issue or factual issue?
To determine the effect of the fact that the governor entered into the compacts without authority. Unless that has already been determined by the court in connection with the other case that will be argued here this morning.
So that's the further litigation where the tribes can get all their money back, right?
Tribes have never joined in our litigation or consented to be joined.
Okay, maybe the governor will say, does he have to give back all this money?
Yes, right? That's possible.
As for a declaratory judgment, right?
That could happen.
Your position is the governor is really representing the tribes.
Well, I believe...
The tribes' interests. That's why they're not indispensable.
That is one of the reasons that we contended that the tribes were not indispensable. I don't think that we succeeded on that issue with the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals ruled on another basis.
Mr. Ragatz, what's the significance, and I have to ask this, of the option that your client has granted to one of the Indian tribes to purchase your property? The record has been supplemented, as I understand, to include that. Is that significant at all for us in this case?
I don't believe it is significant.
Why?
I don't believe it is significant because the reason that it was, that the governor contended that it was significant is that it shows supposedly that this case is about private interests and not public interests. Okay.
And that goes to indispensable party, doesn't it? The way that Court of Appeals...
That would go to the indispensable party issue. In order to follow through with that logic, I think what one would have to say is that this lawsuit by Dairyland is in furtherance of the option that it has entered into and in hopes of facilitating that option coming to fruition as a sale. I think, in fact, the opposite is the case, that if the court were to rule in Dairyland's favor and adversely to Indian casino gaming, that it is much less likely that the holder of the option would exercise it and that the matter would go through to a sale.
Could you amplify what you meant by a possible constitutional amendment spring of next year?
Yes, I would anticipate that if the court were to rule that casino gambling, Indian casino gambling, is not permitted within the state, and the governor did not have, specifically, that the governor did not have authority to enter into compacts to extend or facilitate or, in fact, expand casino gambling, that there would at that point be a constitutional amendment to address, in effect, the prohibition in the 1993 constitutional amendment. What form that would take, we don't know. I mean, there would certainly be a dialogue and a debate both as to the form that it would take and to the merits of it.
Do you mean a constitutional amendment that would accept Indian gambling from what's in there? I don't know what you're really talking about.
Well, in California, the amendment was specifically, their constitution prohibited Indian gaming.
Okay.
The hotel employees case, you will see that the Supreme Court in California said, you can't do this by statute. You can't allow this by statute because we have a constitutional prohibition. They then, by initiative and referendum, passed a constitutional amendment.
I see.
It could take that form, or it could take a broader form, you know, authorizing others within the state to do it, and thereby allowing Indian tribes to engage in casino gambling.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
What exactly did you ask for in your complaint? Let's see. You asked for a preliminary injunction enjoining the defendants from entering into new contracts. That's gone, by the way. Side. Entry of a permanent injunction restraining defendants from entering into new modified. They've already done that. And then you have for such other and further relief as this court deems just and equitable. If you were writing the opinion for the court, this is your big chance. Just outline it for me. What would you say?
I would say that Wisconsin, the governor of the state of Wisconsin, does not have authority to amend, extend.
Governor and the legislature.
And the legislature.
Don't have authority to amend, extend.
Gaming compacts that authorize casino gambling because Wisconsin prohibits such gambling.
And therefore, the following compacts are invalid. What are they? That has to be the bottom line.
That has to be the bottom line. That
is what, 98?
Well, we have asked for... This will have to be addressed when we get back to the trial court. What we asked for was to prevent the renewal, extension, amendment of the existing ones. It's now a fait accompli. Certainly, with respect to the 2003 compacts, that would be the case. And in all honesty, with respect to the 1998 and 1999, I think we would have to sit down and carefully analyze that in light of such questions as have been raised by the court this morning.
But your brief takes the position they're all invalid.
Well, our case has taken the position that the governor had no authority to extend, amend, or renew. I mean, my honest answer is the state did not have that authority in 1998 or 1999 either.
But I want to know. That would be the opinion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John S. Green, Assistant Attorney General, representing the defendant respondents, Governor Doyle, and Secretary Murata. Counsel?
Thank you, and good morning. I am Assistant Attorney General John Green, and I'm here today on behalf of the respondents in this case, Governor Jim Doyle, and Secretary of the Department of Administration, Mark Murata. With me at council table is my colleague, Assistant Attorney General Charles Hornstra, as well as Attorney Douglas Anderson, who will be arguing on behalf of the Amici tribes following my presentation.
He has 5 minutes, according to my notes.
That's correct. Okay. Dairyland's goal in this action is nothing less than the immediate destruction of one of the state's largest industries. It is difficult to overstate the implications of this relief, the loss of jobs, the loss of revenue to the state and local communities, and perhaps most dramatically of all, the adverse impacts on the tribes themselves and their members, for whom gaming revenues are their economic lifeblood. Surely there must be a...
Counsel, you lead with that argument, but what legal relevance is that argument?
That's my next sentence, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, don't let me stop.
I know it was an exciting introduction. Surely there must be a compelling legal justification for such relief. That work?
Thank you. Let's start, Counsel.
Dairyland, however, has presented no such legal theory. Its theory boils down to a simple but totally implausible proposition, and that is the following. The 1993 constitutional amendment compelled Wisconsin's governor to terminate all 11 of the existing tribal gaming compacts. What that meant in practical terms, according to Dairyland, is that Governor Thompson was compelled, as a matter of non-discretion, he had no more discretion, he was required to send notices of non-renewal to all 11 tribes, thereby terminating the compacts at the seven-year mark, which hit in 1998 and 1999. That is their case. That is the only possible basis for their relief in this case.
Counselor, what about another possible basis for relief? What about the 1992 compacts that nobody has specifically terminated? What about those compacts continuing because they've not been terminated?
I would agree that if the amendments in 1998 and 99 and last year are invalidated, arguably the compacts have been rolling over automatically pursuant to the renewal provisions. Now, apparently Dairyland does not necessarily agree with that, but the compacts were not set up to have a fixed term of 7 years, as Mr. Ragus indicated. They were set up to continue indefinitely unless and until either party decided to terminate them at specified intervals.
Okay, so I'm not sure that I agree with this proposition. It's just something that bothered me when I wrote the briefs because nobody addressed it, I guess. But you would agree, then, that if they haven't been terminated and if the later compacts are not void, that we still have the 1992 compacts that have just been rolling over by themselves? Do I understand you correctly?
If the amendments are totally invalid, which I believe is Dairyland's theory, then, yes, I believe that the original compacts have rolled over.
Okay. Thank you.
Did those earlier contracts have a severability clause like the 2003 does?
You know, they're not all identical. The severability provisions were changed in the 2003. I think they're more extensive than the earlier versions.
Thank you.
And by the way, the different tribes now, they have different provisions, and the invalidity of certain provisions in one might trigger an outcome that's not the case with respect to another compact. So it's a little bit complicated.
What were the 1993 amendments all about?
The catalyst for the 1993 amendment was really a report by Governor Thompson's Blue Ribbon Gaming Commission in early 1992 and the State of the State address in which Governor Thompson proposed legalizing non-Indian gaming. And there were lots of proposals at that time to have riverboats in Wisconsin, like our neighbors, and also to allow video gambling devices in taverns. There was a great outcry at that suggestion, and immediately after that, the response was the introduction of an amendment sponsored initially by Senator Edelman to prevent that from occurring. In the history in those subsequent months, which we've set out at length in our brief and appendix, the history shows very clearly that the aim of the legislation, both the statute that was enacted and the constitutional amendment, was to prevent riverboats and video gambling devices and other types of gaming in Wisconsin for non-Indians. What the record is absolutely devoid of, and this is the critical factor, nobody ever believed that the amendment passed in 1993 was going to abolish tribal gaming. Dairyland has never pointed to a single person, even itself, And Darlan was an active player on the scene at the time. Even they didn't understand that the amendment was going to terminate tribal casinos. The sponsors of the legislation, the legislative staff who reviewed it, the legislators who voted for it, the legislators who voted against it, the attorney general, the governor.
What about the public, counsel? This was a constitutional amendment. How do we know what the public thought?
The best we can do with that, Your Honor, is I think look at the media coverage, the editorials and the articles that came out, and those uniformly had the same explanation. This amendment will not affect gaming under the existing compacts or prevent their renewals. In fact, Governor Thompson and Attorney General Doyle traveled the state together shortly before the vote on the amendment, and that's the message they delivered across the state. So I submit that the legislative history is absolutely clear. No one intended to abolish gaming. If they had, the world would have been very different, I believe. First of all, I think the headlines would have been, tribal casinos must shut down in 5 years. That would have been very big news at the time. I don't think the tribe would have invested millions of dollars in developing their gaming infrastructure. I don't believe Governor Thompson would have set out to negotiate extensions of the compacts when he was ordered not to do so. And while he was doing that in a very public way, it was widely reported that Governor Thompson was negotiating to extend the compacts. Why didn't Darlan go in with a simple mandamus action? According to them, the governor had lost his discretion under the compact to agree to extend it. All they would have had to do was waltz in, present their case to the court, and get a writ of mandamus.
Counsel, one of the things you'd look at is what is the ratification question submitted to the voters. And I'm reading from page 6 of Darlan's brief, and here was the question submitted to the voters. Gambling expansion prohibited. Article 4 of the Constitution be revised to clarify that all forms of gambling are prohibited except bingo, raffles, perimutuel, on-track betting, and the current state-run lottery. And to assure that the state will not conduct prohibited forms of gambling as part of the state-run lottery. And that first half seems very broad. Everything's out except the items mentioned. The second half seems to contradict that because it says to assure that the state will not conduct prohibited forms of gambling as part of the state-run lottery. But the state, under these compacts, are not conducting prohibited forms of gaming. It doesn't say anything about anyone else conducting.
First of all, let me point out, I believe the word extension is an error. I believe it's expansion.
You're saying that in the brief, that's the wrong
yes,
word.
Yes, I believe. Okay. I believe they've misquoted.
All right.
The context at the time, I think, is important. At this time, when the ballot measure came before the voters, we had tribal casinos. We had compacts with all 11 tribes. We had slot machines going. We had blackjack. Tribal gaming was established around the state. Nothing in the legislative history, including the ballot question, makes any reference whatsoever to tribal gaming. And if the amendment had been intended to shut the tribal casinos down, surely someone would have said that. No one did. Zero.
Counselor, isn't the argument on the other side that the amendment was in response to Judge Crabb's interpretation of the word lottery to include games beyond what the state anticipated when they authorized the lottery? And isn't that why the amendment supposedly is focused on redefining what lottery is? The initial amendments to the Constitution never said anything about anybody, right? I mean, initially there was no gambling. Then the Constitution was amended and we had a lottery. Then the term lottery was interpreted by Judge Crabb to include a lot of games. And isn't that their argument that the amendment was put in the form it was because it was addressing her opinion, or do you not agree with that?
Well, they have to argue that because the intent is so clearly the other way. That is, there was no intent to affect the gaming complex or their renewals. So what they're trying is to say, well, forget about the intent of the amendment, even though no one intended that. Indirectly, unintentionally, through the back door, they had that effect, and they curtailed the governor's authority because it changed the definition of the state lottery, and therefore it affects the lack of flambeau legal analysis. And on the basis of that, when the governor is looking at what to do with the compacts, he is compelled as a matter of law because of the Constitution to send non-renewal notices. That is what I understand their argument to be, but there's simply no basis for that. There are a couple of severe problems with that theory. First of all, the parties expressly agreed in the compacts that the law, in effect, at the time the compacts were entered, would remain the governing law over those compacts, even if state or tribal law changed. This is a common term in contracts, and when Governor Thompson negotiated on behalf of the state, he agreed to that provision. It's a way to give certainty and security to a long-term relationship.
Well, how can the governor overrule a constitution or a future statutory enactment? How can that be?
Well, federal law does override state law through the doctrine of preemption, and in the area of Indian gaming, federal law is preemptive.
So what part of the federal law prevents the state constitution in a future legislative act?
Well, the compacts themselves take on the force of federal law and are federally enforceable by the tribes in federal court. The tribes most certainly would not give up their gaming rights under the compacts without litigation in the federal courts. And I think that is one certain outcome of the case if Dairyland were to obtain relief here. The tribes will claim, with justification, we have a commitment in the compacts that we're going to be allowed to conduct these games and that subsequent changes in state law do not apply, and the parties have the right to extend the compacts. And Dairyland's position would undermine and eviscerate those compact rights. The rights under the compact have the force of federal law and are preemptive. The state simply cannot change the rules of the game. It would be like the tribe trying to change the rules of the game on their side. They can't do it either.
Is there any difference, counsel, between a mere extension of the 92 compacts, which predate the constitutional amendment, and an expansion of those compacts to include a scope of gambling far beyond what the constitutional amendment would otherwise allow?
And that's a question I think that will come up more in the second case on the 2003 amendments, but Dairyland has not argued in this case. They've not really contested the fact that the compacts automatically roll over. Their theory is that they can't even automatically roll over. You can't even allow the same games as existed in 91 and 92. The governor has an affirmative obligation to terminate even those games. They're taking a very extreme position. And again, under their view, Governor Thompson was required to terminate them all in 1998 and 1999.
But there is a distinction between the 2003 amendments, which significantly expanded the scope of gambling allowed, and the 1998-99 amendments, isn't there?
The 2003 amendments have added new games. That's correct. There are more games allowed now than there used to be.
And the 98-99 amendments did not.
Right.
But they added more slot machines in some of these contracts and more opportunities. They increased the dollar amounts.
Right.
So there were, if you want to, expansions there, right?
Right.
But more slot machines, that's an expansion. May not be an expansion of the type, but it's an expansion.
The key, I believe, is in interpreting a contract, and a compact is a contract, is what was the intent of the parties? What is the intent reflected in the compacts entered in 1991 and 92? And for the reasons we set forth in our brief, we think that intent was very clear, that the parties wanted to protect the terms in place and protect the law in effect at that time. If the legislature or the governor had wanted to start over again and rid itself of some of those terms, then the governor could have issued a non-renewal notice, or the legislature, after the 93 amendment, could have amended the statute 14.035 and directed the governor to send non-renewal notices, and then perhaps specified more limitations on what the governor could or could not agree to in the future. But none of those things occurred.
Counsel, in looking at the words of the Constitution, Article 4, Section 24, Sub 1 says, except as provided in this section, the legislature may not authorize gambling in any form, period. It's a very short section, number one. So except as provided in this section, under our Constitution, the legislature may not authorize gambling in any form. Where in this section is the authorization for roulette? Where in this section is the authorization for keno?
Let's go back to the lack of Flambeau analysis, because what this question really involves, and the question that Darlene wants this court to adjudicate, and one that we think the court lacks the jurisdiction to adjudicate, is the federal effect of the state's gaming laws under IGRA. Those cases typically came up when states refused to negotiate particular games and tribes sued the state, claiming bad faith negotiations. That is certainly not the case before this court, and this court, as a state court, cannot address the question of the effect under IGRA. But let me just address that, because I know if it's of interest and significance. Judge Crabb, in her decision, explained that under IGRA, the word permit, and that's a key term in IGRA, whether a state permits gaming, that does not require an express authorization of gaming by the state. That is, it does not require an affirmative authorization. What it means is, what is the state's policy toward gaming? And today, just as in 1990 and 91, the state has a regulatory policy toward gambling. We have Class 3 gambling. In fact, Dairyland runs a gambling business, Class 3 gambling. The question then is not whether there's an authorization for roulette, for example, but what is the state's policy on roulette, and has it expressly prohibited tribes from conducting that activity?
Your argument then rests on the continued vitality of the Lac de Flambeau decision. Is that correct?
No, I don't think this is relevant and necessary to the court's decision in this case, because we had existing compacts already in effect. By the way, I don't know of any case in the country where we have this scenario, where we have validly entered compacts and then a change in the state's gaming laws.
Let me clarify my question. I think I need to clarify. Your response then with regard to Article 4, Section 24, Sub 1, your response to that question is based on the continued vitality of Lac de Flambeau. Am I correct or not correct on that?
No, it doesn't hinge on Lac de Flambeau. And again, this question would only arise if compacts were terminated now and we're in the position of negotiating brand new compacts, starting over again. Then we'd be back where we were with Lac de Flambeau. And then the question is, what games is the state required to negotiate under IGRA? That's the question that Judge Crabb had before her. We don't have that situation because we already have the compacts in effect that remain in effect through extensions. Secondly, I would submit that even if that were the situation before the court, that is, this court were deciding Lac de Flambeau revisited again, what does IGRA permit, that the games would have to be considered to be permitted in Wisconsin, because at the time the amendment was enacted, we had Indian gaming well established as an activity in Wisconsin. The legislature had passed numerous laws concerning that.
Counselor, let me ask you a question. There's been
argument about the extension of the types of Class 3 gaming that has occurred in the succession of contracts. Is it your position that if the state permits any type of Class 3 gaming, they must permit every type? Or can the state say, yes, we're going to have a lottery, and yes, we're going to have blackjack, but we're not going to have keno, and we're not going to have some other types of games?
There are mixed results in the federal courts on that question. Again, if we were starting from scratch, clearly federal courts have held that states could can prohibit certain games and allow other games.
Within a class.
Within Class 3 gaming. And that's been the case in California. The Ninth Circuit has taken that approach. Again, we're not in that situation here because we have compacts that everyone admits are validly entered and in effect. Those compacts changed the equation. If Wisconsin had wanted to curtail tribal gaming, it easily could have done so. It could have said something about it in the constitutional amendment, or the legislature could have simply amended the statute to require the governor to take certain action or prohibit him from amending compacts on certain terms.
I gather your position would be that in 1990, the legislature and the public wanted to grant a monopoly on casino gambling to the Indian tribe.
I think, yes, there was an acquiescence in the concept that the tribes would have a monopoly on casino games.
Was that discussed?
I believe it was discussed in terms of opposition to the amendment by those who believed it was unfair. For example, tavern owners who believed it was unfairly enshrining a monopoly in the tribe's part when they would not be allowed to offer the same games. So it came up in that context. But again, I think that's important because even those opponents shared the view. They recognized that the amendment was not going to shut down the tribal casinos.
You think the public wanted to authorize video poker, video slot machines and all that sort of thing on reservations, but to prosecute anyone who wasn't an Indian who did that?
I think the public was told and recognized that we already had entered compacts allowing the tribes to operate certain games. And there was not an intent to terminate that activity. Despite the fact that it might set up an unequal playing field. And by the way, that's what IGRA does. And the recent case out of the Ninth Circuit, Artichoke Joe, discusses that. That IGRA contemplates tribal monopolies on gaming. This is part of the federal law on gaming.
Well, what's this new authorization for taverns to have video poker or video games?
Are you referring to a proposed legislation or a recent legislation?
Is there one proposed?
Well, there usually is. I can't say that I'm able to keep up to date on them, but yes, there are proposals introduced.
They will be constitutional according to the proponents?
Now that's a spot I would rather not.
Okay. I withdraw the question.
But can I follow up another question? If we obviously authorize Class 3 gaming with a sports lottery and paramutual contract, paramutual betting. If an Indian tribe came to the governor and said, "We want sports betting. We want to be able run an enterprise where people can bet on the Packers and the Brewers and all the professional sports operated out of our reservation." Would the state be obligated to negotiate on that?
I don't believe so.
Why not?
And this gets into the scope of the Lochner-Flambeau ruling and whether sports betting is a game of prize, chance, and consideration? I suspect not, but I can't say that I've looked at that question in any detail, but I would think that would not be permissible.
Well, if you say that once you open the door to Class 3 gaming, it follows that any Class 3 gaming is lawful, or at least subject to negotiation, I would think that you'd have to come to a different conclusion on that.
My point is simply that I think one would have to look carefully at the elements of the gambling activity to see whether it fell within the definition of lottery at the time of the last Flambeau decision. And I hesitate to address that here, not having studied that. But I think clearly some activities would fall within the scope of gambling under that decision, and some would not.
Also, I'm going to give you the opportunity to write our decision. Can you outline that, please?
The 1993 constitutional amendment was not intended to affect the tribes' rights to conduct gaming activities under their compacts, nor was it intended to prevent or restrict the state from renewing or extending those compacts in the future. Accordingly, Dairyland's argument fails, and the judgment of the Circuit Court is affirmed.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Attorney Douglas B.L. Anderson, representing the Amigai tribes. Good to see you back in Wisconsin, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
May it please the Court, my name is Douglas Anderson. I present argument on behalf of the Amiki tribes. I'd like to begin by describing the tribes' interest in these proceedings and then turn to the merits. The tribes' interest as sovereigns is at stake in this case. After generations of poverty and dire social conditions, Indian gaming has enabled tribes to attack these problems. For example, in 1989, before the compacts were entered into, the poverty rate for reservation Indians in Wisconsin was 48%. 10 years later, in 1999, the rate had fallen to 24.6%. Unemployment for the same period fell from 24% to 14%. The benefits of Indian gaming, though, are not limited to Indian communities. The state's expert found in the court below that 35,000 jobs in this state depend on Indian gaming. Tax revenues are received by the state in addition to the direct payments from the tribes to the state under the compacts. All of this progress, all of these gains are at risk here. Now, very briefly, the tribes have asserted here a right to be free from collateral attacks on their compact rights. And I want to say that that's because in Wisconsin, things were done right. The legislature passed Section 14035, authorizing the governor to enter into compacts negotiated under IGRA. The federal court resolved the scope of gaming question, a federal question. The compacts were then negotiated on the basis of that ruling, entered into under 14035, and went into effect. Those compacts thereafter govern gaming relations between the tribe and the state. And they expressly provide in Section 26 that subsequent changes in state law won't affect the party's compact rights. The critical difference with regard to the merits is that the tribes' rights were established and valid recognized as such under state law and federal law before the 1993 amendment was adopted. These were pre-existing rights. The state had given its word to the tribes in the compacts. IGRA had given the force of federal law to the compacts. When the 1993 amendment was considered and adopted, it said nothing about Indian gaming. It said nothing about the compacts. The question, the gambling expansion question, referred specifically to a state-run lottery. If Wisconsin was going to break its word to 11 Indian tribes, was going to violate the contract clause of the state and federal constitutions, and reverse what had been a tremendous history of success for Indians and non-Indians alike in Indian gaming, someone would have said to the tribes, this is our intent, this is what we are doing. There was no such statement, and the reason is the amendment wasn't intended to affect Indian gaming at all.
Counsel, do you think that the public expected additional Indian casinos after this amendment?
I think the best indication of that, Your Honor, is the public was well aware, as everyone was, of Indian gaming across the state. All 11 tribes had compacts before the amendment was adopted, and understood that this was a part of, for lack of a better term, real life in Wisconsin, a gaming industry that, like other industries, would grow, would change, a relationship governed by the compacts that the tribes and the state had negotiated. This was sovereign-to-sovereign business. I think that was understood, and I think the amendment, viewed in the context of the prior recognition, shows that it intended to change only what it did change, directing the state-run lottery that it couldn't conduct certain games in the future, saying that additional forms of gambling were not to be authorized by the legislature other than those authorized in Section 24. That simply constitutionalized the pre-existing ban on commercial gambling, as the state explained. But it had no effect on Indian gaming. Now, Dairyland suggests that it affected Indian gaming nonetheless under IGRA. Well, there are two answers to that. The first is, Wisconsin isn't compelled, when it enacts a state statute, to seek to terminate Indian tribes' rights, recognized under state law, held under federal law. Nothing suggests the state has to reach out to try to put an end to Indian gaming success. But more fundamentally, as the state has shown, a compact has the force of federal law once it's in effect. These compacts provide that the Class III gaming that the tribes are authorized to conduct is valid as a matter of federal law. IGRA confirms it. IGRA specifically provides that the conduct of Class III gaming under a compact doesn't violate state gambling laws, and the compacts confirm that subsequently enacted state law won't affect the tribe's compact rights.
But can those rights be expanded to other games not included in the original compacts?
Well, as the state indicated, that's a question principally for Panzer. But gaming, like other industries, changes. The parties recognize this. They provided that additional games could be added by amendment. That was stated in the initial compacts in Section 4B, recognized. And the compact, I would emphasize, is not a contract for a transaction. It governs a relationship between two sovereigns in an area that, again, is changing. The Lac de Flambeau ruling provided the rule of law applicable to the compact scope of gaming. And under Wisconsin law, the law in effect at the time a contract is made is part of the contract. This governs the future relations between the tribe and the state.
If the expansion that was accomplished by the 2003 amendments was standing alone, not as an amendment to a pre-existing compact, would it survive under IGRA, which incorporates state law for purposes of determining the allowable scope of gambling?
Well, that's a question I would emphasize, Justice Ice, that the court need not reach, because first, the compacts were already in effect and authorized the tribes to conduct relations under their term. And second, the constitutional amendment wasn't intended to affect the compact rights. But to answer your question directly, I would concur with the state that Wisconsin's policy towards Class III gaming, the lottery and pari-mutuel gaming in particular, is civil regulatory.
For all time, no matter what the state legislature or the voters do?
Well, that's a question that I would urge is not posed here. The question really is, what did the 1993 amendment do? And that amendment, by its plain terms, added to the regulatory scheme that applies to the state lottery, that prohibits the use of public funds for advertising, that requires that odds be included in any advertisement, that directs how the game is to be played. But these regulatory changes don't affect the tribe's rights to conduct lottery games under the Lac du Flambeau ruling by making their own regulatory choices.
So if the people of the state of Wisconsin decided to go cold turkey on gambling and passed a constitutional amendment absolutely prohibiting any form of gambling, that would have no effect?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. I think that a complete prohibition on gaming, I'm not aware of any authority that suggests that wouldn't be effective. What I'm trying to urge is that here the critical difference is that Indian gaming rights were established under state and federal law before the amendment was adopted. And that requires that we ask the question, when the amendment was adopted, what was it intended to affect? What parts of legally authorized gaming activity was it intended to have an impact on? And here, the tribes ask much the same question that you raised. The tribes say, if the state here was seeking to break its word, violate the contract clause, and put gaming back as if it had never happened, shouldn't someone have come forward and said that? And not only did no one say it, but the subsequent actions of the legislature and the governor confirm that the 93 amendment had no impact on Indian gaming. For example, in 1997, the legislature authorized the Secretary of Administration to appoint an attorney to assist the governor in entering into Indian gaming compacts under 14035. And the following year, Governor Thompson entered into amendments to the compacts, and the state received funds pursuant to that which the legislature appropriated. These actions confirm and ratify that the 93 amendment had no impact on Indian gaming rights under the compacts. In conclusion,
that's good, counsel.
We urge this court to recognize that Indian gaming rights were not affected by the 1993 amendment, as the tribes, two governors, the state, have recognized from the time the amendment was adopted. It had no such effect.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Ragatz?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address several points brought up in the presentations. First and foremost is the Artichoke Joe's case and the notion that IGRA, I don't remember exactly the words, contemplates or authorizes monopolies. It's very important to understand the context of the case that was before the Ninth Circuit in Artichoke Joe's, and that is that the state of California had first passed a statute authorizing, in effect, monopoly on Indian casino gambling, and then had amended its constitution to authorize that.
And the issue before the Ninth Circuit was, can the state do that if that's what they have decided to do in their constitution and in their statutes? And they came to the conclusion after a fairly lengthy opinion that, yes, IGRA would allow that. Now, contrast that with the situation here today. What we should be looking for is, if that is the proposal, where is it that the state of Wisconsin has authorized the people, you know, of the state of Wisconsin have authorized this monopoly on Indian casino gaming? If we go back to 1987, which is really the start of this and the premise for the Lac de Flambeau decision, and the questions that were asked then, it's very clear from the questions that were asked, the explanatory note, the legislative file, the news clippings, that no one was talking about casino gambling. And I would refer the court to an LRB memo that was done in 1992, a very thorough analysis of this. It's at R68, starts at 5, and where the Legislative Reference Bureau did a thorough analysis and came to that conclusion. So we start from the premise that the voters didn't believe that they were doing this in 1987, in other words, authorizing casino gambling for anyone. Now, it was interpreted that way in then Attorney General Doyle's opinion in 1991, and that became at least part of the basis for Judge Crabb's decision in the Lac de Flambeau case. Now we're looking at 1993 and what it is that the legislature and the people are intending to do. And I think a few things that bear repeating and fleshing out of this legislative history are that, one, the constitutional amendment is passed and ratified only after the Seventh Circuit has dismissed the appeal from the Lac de Flambeau case, only after this court has declined to take jurisdiction of an original action seeking clarification of the term lottery, and after the LRB had analyzed the proposals and determined that, in fact, he disagreed with the Lac de Flambeau, Attorney General Doyle's assessment as to the meaning of lottery. So I think if you look at the question that was posed to the voters, there's a key word in there that I think is important, and that says, should Article 4 of the Constitution be revised to clarify that all forms of gambling are prohibited except, et cetera, et cetera. Very broadly prohibitory language is included in Section 1, Sub 1 of Section 24 of Article 4. And so what the voters were doing at that point of time is clarifying that we do not allow casino gambling in this state. That's Section 1 of the amendment. Then Section 6 it specifically addresses what can and cannot be done pursuant to the state lottery. So the question then has been raised, or the issue has been raised, that Dairyland is seeking to require the state to break its word, or to eviscerate the compacts, or to change the compacts, or to impair the compacts. That is not the case. Our case is the compacts as written had 7-year terms. They had provisions for renewal or non-renewal that allowed either party to non-renew at their total discretion. This case focuses on how, under state law, the state of Wisconsin exercises and makes that decision, that fundamental public policy decision, of whether these compacts will be renewed or non-renewed, and whether we will have casino gambling all over the state as Mr. Andreessen said, a very large industry, a very large enterprise. Does the state have to follow the state constitution, the public policy set forth, in making that decision? And our answer to that question is emphatically yes.
That's why you think that this is, that the 98 and following compacts are illegal.
Or unauthorized, void. Yes.
And you're how under state law do the state make the compact? And your answer is according to the state constitution.
In accordance with, or not inconsistent with, the state constitution. And, you know, there has been discussion this morning about, this is a federal question. IGRA is a federal statute. If you look at the delegation to the governor, it specifically references IGRA. And the governor himself has argued that that is a substantive limitation or restriction on how it is that that power can be exercised. In fact, that's the only limitation that the governor acknowledges on how the power can be exercised. I do see that my time is up. I very much thank the court for your kind attention.
Are there any questions? Hearing none, thank you, Mr. Ricketts. And thank you, Assistant Attorney General Green and Attorney Anderson, for your arguments today on difficult issues. And we appreciate your briefs and your arguments that were well prepared and responsive to the court's questions. That terminates the hearing on 03-0421, Daryl and Greyhound Park, Inc. versus James E. Doyle. So.